This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Amy Tan is best known for her novels The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, and The Valley of Amazement. Her fiction has drawn on her extended family. Her grandmother was a concubine in China. Tan's mother was married to an abusive husband in China. She left him for another man who had worked with the U.S. Information Service Agency in China as a ham radio engineer. They married and emigrated to America, where Amy and her siblings were born. In America, her father became a Baptist minister. Amy Tan tells her own story in the form of a new memoir titled Where the Past Begins. And in telling her own story, she writes the stories of her parents and maternal grandmother. As part of her preparation, she went through 7 large plastic bins filled with memorabilia, letters, photos, and family documents, including her parents' student visas, notices about possible deportation, and their applications for citizenship, which they did get. She also found condolence cards from when her father died of a brain tumor. Her brother died within a year, also of a brain tumor. Amy Tan was in her teens at the time. Amy Tan, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, it was seeming to me, reading your book, that you had 2 really different sources of seeing the world, one from your mother, one from your father. Your mother was the daughter of a concubine. She grew up in China, and then your mother was married to a man she described as evil, who forced her to have sex, and who, you know, she had, like, what, 5 children with him. One of them died. One of them was stillborn. She runs away with your father and leaves that marriage. And she's always telling you stories about, you know, like curses and ghosts and her mother being a concubine. And then your father becomes a Baptist minister, and he's evangelical and fundamentalist, lots of Bible imagery. And they're both Chinese, but they both come from really different cultures in a way,
yeah,
and really different ways of seeing the world. So did that affect you? Did you feel like you grew up in this like dual brain like household?
Well, the dual brain had to do with mother, father. Mother a little bit hypersensitive, suicidal. Father, honest, cheerful, a leader in the community, yes, very Christian. But what I didn't realize is that I was also getting these 2 different senses of the culture. The one that you described, which included a lot of bad things determined by fate or bad luck or ghosts or karma, and the one of my father that was dictated by God through prayer. And it was always there with my mother, but I didn't know the actual background, the history of her life that had contributed to that. You know, her warnings about men who were going to destroy me and make me want to kill myself. It's not a very good way of introducing your child to, you know, procreation. But, you know, that was always there, and it wasn't, I was getting more of a sense of it when I was writing and asking her questions, but even more when I was doing the research for this book.
I'd be interested in hearing about the understanding of God that your father taught you, your father, the Baptist minister.
God was a voice that came to my father when he was lost. And he was lost because he had had this affair with my mother in China, and he had come to the United States, and he was looking for direction. And he decided, because he came from a very Christian family, he decided that maybe he would find this direction through God. God spoke to him and said, this is the way you go. So my father decided to get a degree at the Berkeley Baptist Divinity School. Now, I always thought that God would talk to me as well. If you believed, if you were going to be baptized, you would have to hear this voice. And I pretended that I heard the voice and walked up the church aisle to say, I believe in Jesus, that I heard the call, and I hadn't. I had lied. And I think, you know, I had this confusion, but I had this other kind of voice in my head. Not a schizophrenic voice, but the voice of your own conscience, in a way. The voice that is your narrative on what you were seeing in the world. And I just wondered, does everybody have that? You know, is it just me that has this running commentary? Now, the voice didn't tell me what to do. It didn't tell me walk up the aisle or sing hymns and, you know, convert people. It made observations, and it told me, you know, what I was seeing and how I would interpret the world.
Yeah, that's why you're a writer.
I think a lot of, I don't know, do you do that? I mean,
yeah, I kind of do. And I'm not a writer, but I've always had this kind of like narration in my head of like,
yeah,
what's going
exactly.
on. Yeah.
But, running commentary, you know.
But did you feel the sense of guilt, like you're lying to yourself, to the congregation, to your father, and to God?
Especially to God, you know, because I knew that he knew, you know, he knew I was lying, that I hadn't heard him. He hadn't spoken to me yet. But I thought it was what was good about this, you know, my father talking about the voice and you're having to have this belief and make the declaration of the belief that what you had to do was really know what you believe and you had to really feel it. Now, I didn't feel it in the way he wanted me to feel it, but it gave me that sense early in life, this importance of belief. The difference is, in my father's world, the beliefs are handed to you, and you are told this is what you must do in your life based on these edicts that are issued by the Bible. It's very literal. And I reached an age where not only was I rebellious because I was a teenager, my father and my brother died. Now, that's going to kick into gear a really huge rebellion. And I got to discard all these beliefs. I was forced to in order to survive.
So when you were growing up with your mother's stories about ghosts and your father's belief in God, did you see the difference between ghosts and God, or did they kind of combine in your mind as two things, that two different forces that were powerful and unseen and mysterious that you couldn't quite comprehend?
They were sort of a, you know, the same kind of force, but they were a different, say, genre. One was magical realism, and the other was a different kind of magical realism. I don't know if I can call Christianity realism. And, you know, it's not that I'm poo-pooing people who are Christians. But one of the differences with my mother, of course, is that there was a kind of faith that was guided by the unknown, and or something called luck or bad luck, or she would guess sometimes it was karma or feng shui. Whereas my father's sense of fate was really based very strongly on faith, and those would make the decisions. There would be miracles. You would have blessings come into your life. And if you didn't, you had to be patient, and God would show you the way. So I grew up with these, you know, two different versions of fate. And I would say that at a certain age, I would prefer, of course, the Christian one that wasn't full of bad things. Because in my mother's world, fate also had to do with curses. And you feel kind of helpless when there's a curse going on in your life.
Did you hear a lot of biblical language? Did your father read from the Bible a lot at home? And were there passages that stood out in your mind? And I'm also wondering if there are ones that seemed very important in either a beautiful or an ominous way that you didn't quite understand and maybe misinterpreted. I'll offer as an example. When I was growing up, and I heard the psalm with the Valley of the Shadow of Death, which they used to read in school all the time because this was before Bible readings were banned from public schools. I always thought that sounds really powerful, the Valley of the Shadow of Death. But there was also the Valley of Fatigue on these ads for something called Geritol that was supposed to be this tonic to like lift you out of the afternoon sleepy slump. And uh-huh. So I didn't understand. I was very young and I didn't understand the difference between the Valley of the Shadow of Death and the Valley of Fatigue. They both sound really like ominous to me and maybe connected in this way that I couldn't comprehend.
When I think of the that psalm, what I picture is a pile of dead people. You know,
it's terrifying.
I know. I grew up listening to this from the time I was a baby. All our friends were Christians. I heard, I sang hymns. I think one of the ways that I learned to read is that I was trying to read the same words that were in the hymns, God, Amen, Christ. You know, so my father's language to people, in fact, was these quotes from the Bible, may God bless you and keep you. And I read those now in his letters, and I was disappointed. I was so proud of him when I was a kid, but I was disappointed because it seemed to me they were like pat phrases, and that's what I grew up with. They were very comfortable things to say. Mm-hmm. You knew exactly, you know, the right sentiments. Now, I do have a favorite passage, and it's, I think it's Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, and it's about love. And I wanted to keep that in mind, that this is the quality of Christianity that people should not forget. You know, that Christianity means love. And it's not intolerance. It's not about, you don't believe what I believe, and so, you know, you're cut out. You don't get the go beyond the red velvet ropes and get into heaven.
When your father and your brother were dying of brain tumors, and they died within a year of each other, your mother brought in faith healers and karma adjusters. Was your father aware of that?
Not really. I think that she was able to hide a lot of these beliefs from him until after he died, or was pretty close to dying, and his cognitive abilities were impaired. But she would call in these feng shui people to see if there were imbalances in our house. She would count bad things that had happened in the neighborhood into different neighbors and say, I should have seen this. She called in people who were babbling in tongues, and I knew at that point she'd gone crazy. She brought pot stickers to the cemetery to give to my brother. She saw signs in everything, and I would say the signs are what a lot of people would see when a loved one's dying. You know, you feel something, you believe something when somebody squeezes your hand, and doctors will say that's a reflex, but my mother took it as a sign. A really huge sign, as great as, you know, my father believing in miracles.
So your mother believed that there might be a curse on the family, yeah, that caused the death of your brother and your father, and that the same curse might also affect your mother in the future and you and your younger brother. Did you believe that? Did you worry that there was a curse that might come and get you too? You were 15 when your father and brother died.
I both believed it and rejected it. You know, when you have a brother who's dying and a father who's dying, and you see them and their head has, you know, been shaved and they have stitches like railroad tracks across them, you're scared. And so somebody says, you know, there's a curse and this is going to happen to you, you end up half believing it. And then you push it away. You cannot believe, you cannot imagine yourself looking like that. So I also tried very hard to reject that. But I would say that I believed it more than I didn't, because I was fearful. And whenever we had a headache or whenever anything went wrong, my brother and I would look at each other and we would wonder if this curse was beginning again.
So you must have thought a lot about death and your own mortality when you were in your mid-teens.
I did, you know, and it started then. It's confronting me every day. I'd go to the hospital, or I'd hear people talking about it. But I also heard a lot about the opposite, which was the miracle. I will say, as a consequence of these experiences with death at a very early age, death is something I think about every single day. And not with a grimness, not with the sense of the curse that my mother had instilled in us, but with this notion you have to think about your life every day. And is what you're doing meaningful? Did you discover something new today? What do you believe at this moment? And I think it's a wonderful perspective of life. I mean, people think that I'm paranoid or I think they're avoiding the inevitability that this is going to happen. But this is true, I think, of a lot of writers. You think about death or you think about obsessions. You have obsessions that others would not have. And this fed, I think, directly into my writing. When I look at the nature of a narrative, that you are making certain decisions leading up to a point that is a belief, or you're discovering that belief. And whether you think that what has happened is coincidental, or is it a kind of fate, or is it inevitability because of character? And all of this early background of what to believe in is part of my fiction.
Let's talk about your mother. Her mother, your mother's mother, was a concubine. What does being a concubine mean? What did it mean?
A man had a first wife, and then he could have other wives. They were referred to with the title number two wife, number three wife, but essentially they were mistresses, and they lived in the house. Concubines were a very low position. Wives were, right there in society, and concubines were not. Now, if you were a concubine, you were not really fit to remarry somebody who was in a well-to-do family. So my grandmother, who had been, we thought, the first wife of a scholar, now was somebody quite low. And there was a shame associated with it. My mother used to cry about this and say, "You don't understand. This was China. You're an American. This was a shame. We could never wash off our backs. This is a shame I still have." And it's taken me a long time to realize, you can't look at these from an American point of view of, no, you were a victim of society, of course it's washed off your back. This is an emotion, I realize, that you can't. It's just stuck in you.
So, your grandmother killed herself when your mother was 9. So your mother was exposed to suicide at a very young age. And then throughout your childhood, your mother threatened to kill herself. She nearly threw herself out of the car when all the children and your father were in the car and she was in the front passenger seat. Do you think that her mother's death created suicide as a constant possibility in her own mind?
Absolutely. Because oftentimes in her threat, she would say that she wanted to join her mother. She said when she described the funeral of her mother that she was trying to fly off with their mother. She would have this feeling. It was like an uncontrollable feeling that she needed to leave. And sometimes she said she was going back to China, but most of the time she said she was going to kill herself. So it was always with anger, and this would seethe for days, and she would not speak to anybody. And because, I would say, there were times when she would say it, once a week or more. And then there would be relatively peaceful times when she didn't say it for a month or two. But when she did, we always had to take it seriously because she had tried. You'll only need to have your mother try once before you are quaking every single time she says that.
You think your mother was mentally ill. Did she ever have a diagnosis?
She never had, she never saw a doctor about this mental illness, and I do think she had one. I would say it was depression. And she might have had a personality also that my grandmother had, maybe what people would call borderline. I don't really know all these terms and what they mean, but I have a number of friends who are psychiatrists. And I think part of the meaning is that whatever she is feeling, you are supposed to feel. And that I found to be true. It was really one of the ways that I was able to get along with her where I could stop these suicidal tendencies in her. I would say I understood her, that when she was angry, I would be angry. I would be furious to match her anger. And that was the only thing that would calm her down.
I think it's a really hard for a lot of daughters to break away from their mothers and to differentiate their own personality from their mothers and their own destiny. But for you, the way you've described it, where you had to kind of feel what your mother was feeling, in part to like help protect her from suicide, was it hard for you, more difficult than it might ordinarily have been, for you to break away and establish who you were and what you thought your direction should be, since you had mastered the art of feeling what your mother was feeling?
I think it was hard only in the sense that I was feeling I had betrayed her. I no longer wanted to feel and be her compatriot in fury and depression. When I wrote the first book, The Joy Luck Club, I immersed myself back into her mind, but in a way that I could understand her. I didn't have to just take the exterior part, the manifestation of anger that came out of this subtext that I didn't know about. I could live her life again. It was as if I was there, the witness in the room, and somebody who became her in the fiction. And I knew her. My mother sensed that. She that was the only book she read of mine. Mm-hmm. And she said at the end of that, "You know me. I don't have to say anymore."
So one more thing. Your mother believed in ghosts. Your mother died in the late 90s. When you write about her now in memoir form, not disguised in fiction, do you feel like she knows what you're saying about her and that you have to be careful what you say?
Absolutely, she knows. She's right there. She's my truth detector. I was about to say something else, but she's my truth detector. And I do, I have thought about what she might have thought or what she's thinking or what my grandmother is thinking about the things that I'm writing. But they were so much about the truth. It's no longer about what society thinks. That absolutely, I think that they would be not only approving but grateful that I am saying the things that were true in our lives.
Amy Tan, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Tan's new memoir is called Where the Past Begins. The hurricanes and wildfires that have dominated the news this fall make a new nonfiction book about a deadly London smog seem particularly timely. Here's our book critic Maureen Corrigan's review of Death in the Air.
A real pea souper, a London particular. Those nicknames for the quintessential foggy day in London town always make it sound so quaint, an impression that's been intensified in art and literature. Certainly the London of Sherlock Holmes would be a lot less mysterious without that obscuring fog. And Impressionist painter Claude Monet, who famously depicted the Houses of Parliament shrouded in mist, said that, without the fog, London would not be a beautiful city. It is the fog that gives it its magnificent breath. Monet was talking about an added dimension to the city. But breath, as in human breath, was precisely what the fog stole from London in the terrible winter of 1952. For 5 days in December of that year, London was blanketed by a yellow, toxic vapor that smothered its inhabitants. By the time this poisonous air mass moved on and death records were correctly tallied, some 12,000 people would be recognized as fatalities of what was called the Great Smog of 1952. Journalist Kate Winkler Dawson has written an intriguing book about this silent disaster, which was born out of a perfect storm of freak weather patterns and environmental ignorance. The moist air of the Gulf Stream stalled for days over London that winter, long enough for there to be a deadly buildup of soot, sulfur dioxide, and other poisons emitted from the cheap sea coal, known as nutty slack, that most Londoners use to heat their flats and houses. The great smog also gave off a great stink, acrid and burning. In fact, on the cover of Dawson's book, there's an arresting black-and-white photograph of a young woman wearing a pearl choker and a tweedy-looking suit with her chiffon scarf wrapped around her mouth like a face mask. That photograph is no doubt meant to be suggestive of Dawson's other disturbing subject here. Death in the Air attempts to be a kind of true crime book about two stranglers on the loose in London that winter. One, an environmental killer, the smog. The other, the infamous serial killer, John Reginald Christie, who lured women to his Notting Hill flat and murdered them by suffocation. He is responsible for at least 8 deaths. Those parallel plot lines never quite intersect. Death in the Air would have been an even more compelling book without Dawson's somewhat forced attempt to make connections between these two London stranglers. Another strike against the Christie story is that his grisly career has been exhaustively documented in books and films. The Great Smog, however, was underreported when it happened, and it's still not all that widely known. It seems an even more timely tale in our own age of extreme weather and environmental catastrophes. Dawson cuts a precise narrative path through the smog by marshaling together an array of government and newspaper reports and interviews with people who lived through those terrible 5 days when trains, buses, and ships on the Thames came to a standstill and crime was rampant. Most affecting are the first-person recollections of a woman who was 13 years old that winter. Rosemary Sargent's working-class neighborhood had been bombed during the Blitz, and she and her siblings had been separated from their beloved father for years during the war. When the Great Smog began, Rosemary's father, his lungs already weakened by war work, started gasping for air. She and her mother stumbled to the doctor's office to get a nitroglycerin tablet. By the time they returned, Rosemary's father had died. He had to be laid out in the parlor of their small house for 2 weeks. As Dawson says, one of the most astonishing things about this deadly fog was who it first alarmed. Not politicians, reporters, or even doctors, but undertakers. Across London, funeral directors reported a surge in bodies, so many that the demand for caskets was insatiable. When the smog finally lifted, it took months, even years, for officials to realize that the thousands of deaths attributed to heart disease or the flu were really caused by the toxic air. In 1956, Britain passed the milestone Clean Air Act, which tightened restrictions on industrial smoke and banned coal in many houses and industries. Dawson says it was the first comprehensive legislation to attack air pollution. The number of fog events and deaths immediately dropped. The lessons for the present, Dawson suggests, are as clear as the air in front of our eyes.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Death in the Air by Kate Winkler Dawson. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Noah Baumbach is best known for writing and directing the films Francis Ha, Greenberg, and The Squid and the Whale. His new film, The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, is a comedy with a lot of real emotional pain. It's about the complicated mix of love, resentment, and anger in a complicated family. It revolves around three adult siblings who share a father. The older brother and sister are from the father's second marriage. The younger brother is from the third marriage. The father, who's now in his fourth marriage, is played by Dustin Hoffman. He's a self-absorbed sculptor who believes he's an important artist who's never gotten the recognition he deserves.
He never paid much attention to his first two children, Danny and Jean, played by Adam Sandler and Elizabeth Marvel, but they're the ones who still live close to him in New York and look out for him. His youngest son, Matthew, played by Ben Stiller, has moved 3,000 miles away to L.A., where he's a successful money manager. He's flown back to New York to arrange for the sale of his father's house and artwork, but he hasn't told his half-siblings. When his half-brother finds out about the plan to sell the house, he's incensed. Here's Adam Sandler as Danny, with Dustin Hoffman as his father and Emma Thompson as his father's fourth wife.
Thinking about selling the house? Why?
It's very expensive to keep this place up, and we're spending more time at the country house now.
But the country's yours.
Well, I had it before we were married, but it's ours. Everything is ours now.
You're selling all of the art? Damn, why?
We don't have room for it.
Do you want to sell?
Oh, come on. Cabrera just ground it into a double play.
Matt set this up?
I told him it was a family discussion.
I think it is. I don't think you should sell at all. I'm telling you.
Didn't expect you to get so upset about it.
I am. I am upset about it.
Why do you care?
I don't know. We've lived here for years.
You haven't. This is where Matthew grew up. You lived in Queens with your mother.
It's a Meyerowitz tradition, this house.
Well, I guess I wouldn't know about that.
I didn't mean it like that.
She gets sensitive about these things. She feels like an outsider. She doesn't have kids of her own. I tell her, technically, you're their stepmother.
Noah Baumbach, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I love this movie, and it's about what so many families are like now, different sets of parents and siblings, and all the opportunities that presents for more resentments and maybe sometimes more love. And I would say you're very sympathetic to all of the characters in this movie, except maybe not so much the father. How would you describe his type of narcissistic personality? And this is the character played by Dustin Hoffman, who's an artist who has like the utmost confidence that his work is great, underrecognized, but great.
Well, I think he has the utmost confidence in a certain way, but I think there's some aspect of him too that feels like a failure. And I think in that way, I do have a lot of sympathy for him and love for that character, because I think he is in a lot of pain. He just can't access it.
The Dustin Hoffman character, the father, he's a sculptor and a college teacher, and he thinks he's worthy of much more recognition than he's received. His friend LJ has just had a museum show at the Museum of Modern Art. And so the father kind of has to convince himself and everyone else that LJ isn't really all that talented, because if LJ is that talented, he's kind of like a threat to the Dustin Hoffman character. At least that's how I see it. So he starts telling his son, you know, ultimately LJ is a popular but unimportant artist. It's a disturbing commentary on the culture that truly ordinary work gets reverent reviews by the critics. I feel like you've heard that. That like you've almost like borrowed that from things you've read or heard people say.
Well, it was something that Dustin and I talked about when we did that scene, that, you know, because, you know, Harold goes to this opening of his friends, you know, and it's this big retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, which would be sort of the pinnacle of, you know, or a pinnacle of, you know, an artist's career. And you know, Harold is feeling unseen and unrecognized. And actually, all around him, people are being, you know, LJ is very nice to him and trying to involve him and include him in the festivities, and introduces him to Sigourney Weaver. But Harold really only knows how to feel slighted, I think. But to your question, they're definitely a version of things I've heard. This sort of notion that someone else needs to be lesser than so you can feel better. You know, I mean, Harold, you know, definitely lives in that kind of mindset.
So since this movie is so much about the children of divorce and of half-siblings from two separate marriages, when your parents divorced, did they marry other people and have children with those other spouses?
They didn't have children, but they both married again.
I'm wondering if your parents became different people when they were no longer a couple. Because I think most people change depending on who they're with. I think most people have, I think most people have some kind of personality code switching in addition to maybe language code switching, where you're funny with one person and you're more serious with another, and,
sure,
you know, you talk more with one person and less with another person. You know, you're more quiet and introverted with one person than another. So did your parents change when they became couples with different people, and did you change when you became part of those different units?
Yeah, I'm sure they did, and I mean, I observed it, and I'm sure they did in ways that at that time I didn't even see. I mean, I remember like the first Christmas after they separated, and both of them got these big bushy trees, and we'd always had these really bony trees, and I remember thinking like, why didn't we do this when we all lived together? Why now do we have the good tree? Which is maybe a symbolic version of what you're saying. You know.
Do you think that watching your parents divorce and remarriages made you any more or less enthusiastic about the prospect of becoming a parent yourself?
I've thought about that. I mean, and also I'm divorced now and myself. You know, consciously, I'd say no, actually. But, you know, I think it has to have affected things. I didn't really, I mean, I remember people asking me that because I got married around the time that Squid and the Whale came out. And people saying, oh, how ironic, you know, that maybe they didn't quite phrase it that way to me, but they were thinking it probably, that, you know, you've just taken this leap and yet you're telling this story of a marriage falling apart. And I, you know, it didn't seem strange to me at the time. I wanted to get married.
So when you did divorce and it wasn't long after your son was born, did you feel like, oh, how can I do this to my son? Like, my parents did this to me, how can I do it to my son?
Yeah, you know, it's such a bad time, and I just felt bad all over. I mean, I didn't even feel it that kind of dramatically, like, oh no, I've done the same. I just felt like I wish this wasn't happening.
Yeah, yeah. So part of what happens in your movie is that the father is hospitalized, and I don't want to give away too much of the story, but the two sons and the daughter, and the older son and daughter are from one marriage, the younger son is from another marriage, but they all have the same father. They're all in the hospital, you know, trying to watch over their father and deal with the doctors and the nurses and all the medical issues you have to deal with when someone's in the hospital. Had you had a hospitalization experience with someone who you're close to or yourself?
Yeah, I mean, that experience was, you know, in some ways came from my own experience being in the hospital. I mean, being with somebody who was in the hospital. And at the time, I mean, that just horribly vulnerable feeling. But I did find something also sort of comic about it too, just how the nurse that you think, you know, understands and is the caretaker is suddenly relocated to another floor, and you've got a new nurse who doesn't have the same information, and you know, might be passive aggressive, and that just that sort of frustration of trying to deal with all of these complicated emotions in an institution like a hospital. And when it was after I made The Squid and the Whale, and I met Mike Nichols, and he said it was one of the better compliments I've gotten in my career. But he said, you know, it reminded me of why I got into movies in the first place, which is revenge. you know, in a way, I think you could say in some way, particularly, it was my, not revenge on an individual, but my revenge on a time in my life.
So one of the issues for the sons is it okay to leave for a while? I love it when, like, the Ben Stiller character says to the nurse, so, like, I have a meeting with a client. Is it okay for me to leave?
Yeah.
Like, asking the nurse for permission. But I've been in that situation with my parents, and, like, you don't know if it's okay to leave. First of all, you feel guilty about just even walking out of the room. And second of all, like, you don't know, is there going to be drama if I leave for an hour or two? Or even longer? Like, are they going to still be alive? Is there something that terrible that's going to happen? Are we at a transition point? Like, what's going on? But then the nurse or the doctor looks to you like that's your choice, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That Well, I was thinking in a way that the hospital sort of takes the place of a kind of parental role in a way for them, because it is like in absence of having the parent there, you're looking to all these other people to tell you it's okay, and you know, what should I do? You don't know what the protocol is or the process is, and you know, at the same time, I think there's almost this sort of like, for some people, it's like they get angry and confrontational, and for other people, they get kind of like overly polite, you know, and sort of like they don't want to say the wrong thing for fear of some kind of retribution or something.
The Dustin Hoffman character, the narcissistic father, who's so wrapped up in his art and thinks his art is really great and that he's unrecognized, he's such a recognizable father figure. Did you base it on anybody in your life? And is that an uncomfortable question to answer?
Well, my grandfather, who was named Harold.
Like Dustin Hoffman's character.
Like Dustin Hoffman's character, was a painter. And we used to go to, this is back where you could be a painter and teacher and have a townhouse in Brooklyn Heights. But we would go to their home on Henry Street, and he would take us up to his studio, and he would put up the new work for us to see. And he would say things like, "I think this one's a masterpiece." And then, you know, we would all nod. And, you know, and I remember feeling very intimidated by it because I couldn't understand, you know, he was painting abstractly at that point, and I couldn't understand it as a kid. But I heard all about, you know, stories of him, and he was contemporaries with Milton Avery and Rothko, and there were all these sort of reasons given why he wasn't kind of on their level and success-wise. And it was his sort of irascibility, his, you know, he was known for taking work down off walls if people didn't, you know, gallery walls, and people didn't appreciate it correctly. Or he died when I was in my 20s, and he had like a show at Brooklyn College that we all went to when I was in my 20s. And so a lot of that kind of, I guess, was inspired by him.
So did your grandfather pay attention to you?
Yes, but I think it was clearly on his terms, you know.
Was it your job to admire him?
I think I kind of knew that intuitively, but I posed for him once, you know, like I wanted to get my painting done. I remember that was something that meant a lot to me because other people in the family had gotten their portraits. But by the time I was doing it, things were much more abstract, and I felt like I wanted mine to look like me, and it didn't. Whereas he had done portraits earlier in his career that kind of looked like, you know, they were more realistic, and mine looked like some kind of ghost or something.
You grew up in Park Slope, and the home that you grew up in was also used as the home in the movie Heartburn, mm-hmm. which has a screenplay by Nora Ephron, and it's based on her divorce from, I want to say, Dustin Hoffman.
Carl Bernstein.
Carl Bernstein, yes. He plays Carl Bernstein in All the President's Men. And her, Nora Ephron's actual divorce was from Carl Bernstein. So that's hilarious. Did you feel 6 degrees of separation from Dustin Hoffman before you started working with him?
Well, I mean, I had great love for Dustin Hoffman before I knew him because of, you know, all the movies I'd seen him in. I mean, he felt very much part of my childhood. Yeah, but Mike Nichols directed Heartburn, who I got to know and become friends with, which was great. So I did have that sort of like connection. And it also was a movie that sort of had like so much talent in it. It was Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson and Catherine O'Hara and Stockard Channing. And then also like Milos Forman was in it. And Nestor Almendros was the cinematographer who I shot all these great French New Wave movies I later would love. And so when I look back on like all those people who were in our kitchen, it was kind of amazing.
So did you learn anything about filmmaking when Heartburn was shot in your home? Were you on set? Did Mike Nichols let you watch what was happening? How old were you?
I think I was like 16 or something. Mm-hmm. One thing that happened was there was a hurricane came that weekend, or at least it was gonna come. I think it was it was downgraded eventually, but they couldn't shoot. They were supposed to only be in our house for a few days, but then they had to break down and wait. So all the equipment was left in our home, including the hot set. And so we kind of lived for a few days sort of in and around the movie while we waited out this hurricane. But, you know, I don't know that I consciously did, except it was the only time I'd ever been on a film set until I made my first movie. So when I did make Kicking and Screaming, which was my first movie, I was 24 when I made it. That was like what I thought, well, I remember this from this or that from Heartburn. I remember the PAs, like, or how the AD talked, or how it was sort of my only, you know, instruction manual for, you know, the sort of protocol of a movie set.
Why was it your house that was chosen?
It was totally random. It was also a double for a Washington, D.C. home. And at the time, it was like being cast in a movie. I thought, I was so excited about it. And I really couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe, because movies, you know, I loved movies and I went to movies all the time. My parents loved movies. We all talked about movies all the time. But making movies was not, we didn't know anybody who did it. And I had no inside knowledge of movies or how they got made or anything. And so it really seemed like this kind of dream come true that this movie would be made in my home. You know, now the idea of a movie crew coming into my home sounds horrible. I would do everything to avoid it. But then it was like, you know, it really did feel like we were cast somehow. Somehow we got to be in a movie.
Well, Noah Baumbach, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Noah Baumbach wrote and directed the new film, The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected. It's streaming on Netflix and playing in select theaters.